Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy. Here's truth. Men and women don't experience the economy the same way. Despite what some folks believe, minimum wage, paid sick time, or even Social Security impacts the lives of men and women differently. The fact is, women pay more. There's something called the pink tax. Women pay more for everything from dry cleaning to car repairs to health insurance. That's according to a study entitled From Cradle to Cane, The Cost of Being a Female Consumer. You know, women make less money for the same work that men do. They pay more for the same products and services that men do. And yet the cost that they have to face for everything from bread to gasoline is the same. Women have to take more time off in order to give birth. But on the other end of the spectrum, they have to take time off to care for elderly relatives as well. The majority of Americans working for minimum wage? You guess it, women. Take my good friend Chanel. She's 22 years old. She's a single mom, and she's raising two kids. And she's trying to make ends meet on minimum wage and a $400 a month subsidy from the federal government. She wants to be a nurse one day and is in school and studying hard to realize that dream. She's smart. She knows she can do it, but it's a struggle every day. She has to get her kids to the doctor appointments, school. She has to budget for food. She has to stay in school so she can maintain her housing and afford diapers. And of course, she has to reach for her dream. Chanel's not alone. 42 million Americans live in poverty, and two-thirds of folks working for minimum wage are women. Republicans have long promised to cut initiatives that help low-income and moderate-income people. And in Trump's most recent budget, he does just that. Once we recognize that women are treated unequally in this economy, we need to commit to fixing it. There are millions of women around the country fighting for equal pay, for better working conditions, and for an end to sexual harassment, which is a burden women disproportionately carry than men. But in the age of extreme right-wing politics, the age of Trump, how do we fight to make our society better? Let me introduce my friend Ariana Hanis, who is an activist in Minneapolis and a co-host of the podcast Latina Theory. I asked her about the challenges women face in this economy, specifically women of color.
Women specifically, cis and trans, are caregivers. I think we're socialized to be caregivers in a lot of ways. I don't think we're inherently caregivers. But I think that the result of that is that we are often assumed that responsibility, whether that be as parents, as mothers, whether that be as older siblings, cousins, whatever. And I think that makes a huge difference. And what I mean by that is, you know, I worked on the paid Earn Sick and Save Time campaigns locally here in Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and now it's moving in Duluth as well. And through that campaign, the things that we learned is that, you know, both men and women use paid sick times to stay home when they're sick. But when asked, like what they used those times, like that time for, the majority of men responded that they used it when they were sick, whereas the majority of women responded that they used it when their kids were sick or a family member was sick. And so I think immediately then you see a difference about how women are experiencing the economy differently, and the expectations that are put on them, the responsibilities that they have to work with. And so I think the other thing to add about that is that, you know, paid sick and safe time is just one example of how the economy isn't working for women in a ton of ways. I think the other thing to highlight with it is that this whole notion of like a nuclear family with, you know, a heterosexual nuclear family where the woman doesn't have to work and so forth is a reality that was, you know, just isn't real for so many women in this country, and in many ways has never been real for so many women of color, indigenous women, and poor women. That just has never been an option to not work. And so what you see there is that if women do have paid sick time, if they don't, they're often also the ones that are dealing with the responsibilities of having to, you know, when if the bus doesn't work, if the bus line isn't working, they have to then take time off that they're not going to get paid for to figure out how they're going to get their kids to school or daycare or their family member. Like one, you start to see over and over again how these things structurally impact women and how that means that women are going to experience the economy differently than men.
Elise Hoge has been an activist for more than 20 years, and she's the president of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, known as NARAL, Pro-Choice America. She talked about how women are treated differently from men and how that affects their families.
Absolutely. I mean, let me just point to a news article from last week where there was a little social experiment conducted at a small employment agency in the Midwest, and a man named Martin ended up swapping email signatures with his coworker Nicole for 2 weeks. And one of the things that they experienced was that Nicole had the most productive 2 weeks of her life just with a man's name on her email signature. And Martin experienced some challenges that he had never experienced before in his work with his clients. Dismissiveness, hostile questioning, assumptions that he didn't know what he was talking about. And, you know, they both went to their boss at the end of the experiment because one of the things Martin had been told by his boss is that Nicole was slow and she couldn't get her work done quick enough. And he went and said to the boss, hey, listen, I just pretended to be Nicole for 2 weeks and I couldn't get my work done either. The boss was actually not all that sympathetic, but I think that the anecdote is really illuminating. And one of the things that both participants in the experiment noted is that they feel like that the hostility that the Nicole email signature experienced in their work with clients would have been even more if this was someone with a Latin name or a traditionally African-American name. And all of that is underscored and confirmed by external data, and it's not just once you're in a job. Just resumes coming from women are less likely to get looked at, and that's absolutely true. Multiple fold if you have a name that does not sound white. So that's just entry into the job market. Now, one of the things that we know, of course, your listeners will all be familiar with, is the pay gap, right? The pay gap is 81 cents on the dollar for white women and goes down from there for black women and Latino women and Native women. It goes slightly up for Asian women, but certainly doesn't come close to what men make. And one of the things that we have to take into account when we look at the pay gap is that that's not just a one-to-one experience. You've got 3 out of 4 women in the workforce with kids and 2 out of 3 that are the primary breadwinners. And so when you're talking about a pay gap, you're talking about women generally and specifically women of color having to stretch a dollar further and further and further to actually take care of their family. And that obviously has ramifications on their children, the education they can get, the nutrition they can get. So this bias is everywhere. And we talk about the fact that you have implicit bias, which some of these experiments show, combined with overt oppression, people who are out there trying to hold women down, trying to hold poor women down, women of color down. And that the combination of the two is an extremely powerful social force that means we can't pass policies that would allow women to just have equal opportunity as their male counterparts.
Many Americans hoped 2016 was going to be the year we elected the first woman president to the White House. We were all excited to see that glass ceiling come shattering down. Instead, we saw the first female nominee of any major party lose to the most brazenly misogynistic candidate in modern history, Donald Trump, the man who said the most disgusting things that need not be repeated here because we all know what they are. And yet, he won with the support of over 50% of white women who voted. We need to figure out how to step it up in 2017 and beyond to make America as fair as we know it can be. Sure, we'll acknowledge women have made huge gains in employment, education, and economic life since the 1960s. But are we really going to compare women's economic fortunes today to a time when we had total state-sponsored misogyny? when we had state-sponsored patriarchy? You know, we can say that we've come a long way, but comparing today to a completely unequal and state-sponsored unequal society is cold comfort. We can and must do better. The rise of the right could dramatically affect women's prospects for the future, and they are aggressive and on the march. Just look at the Republicans' replacement alternative to the Affordable Care Act or the Trump budget, which just came out of the chute. I asked Elise Hoag about what the rise of the right means for women.
I think there's two pieces to that. I think that there is a piece where we sort of, you know, I say often we gambled big on misogyny and we lost. And one of the reasons that we lost is because Trump isn't the forward edge of misogyny. He's a reflection of so much of society around us. So some of these women were hearing these comments and being asked to disqualify a presidential candidate based on them. And they're sitting there thinking, I hear that all the time. I hear it at work. I hear it at home. So when we're asking them to reject a presidential candidate, they're thinking, well, if I do that, do I have to reject my husband? Do I have to reject my boss? And that's a pretty scary proposition for people, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, on the flip side, we see that the sort of misogyny, we're all a product. You know this better than anyone. We're all a product of the society in which we are raised.
And yeah.
We saw an enormous amount of internalized misogyny on the left throughout the election.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, that's not to say, of course, that there are perfectly reasonable reasons to critique any candidate, including a woman candidate. But we saw a reflection of misogynistic tropes among the left throughout the election. And I think that combination became just too much to overcome. And, you know, Trump won. Now, what I will say, which we all know, but it's important to point out, is that he won by 70,000 votes in a few states, right?
Yeah.
And so that does say to me that the 3 million popular votes that Hillary actually won, it does tell us that we are in the throes of a culture that is grappling with this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? And we've got to continue pushing in the right direction.
Yeah, and what does it mean? I mean, you're right. Trump's not the only one who says this kind of stuff. You might have some crew chief at McDonald's saying gross, nasty stuff to the female workers around him, and, you know, they have to figure out how to get through the day anyway. And that's just reality, sadly, for so many women in our society. But what does it mean when people say they want to criminalize and punish abortion? What message does that send? What does it say to women about their own personal autonomy?
Yeah, I mean, we're saying terrible things, right? We're actually saying a couple of different things if you listen closely. We're saying that women should be ashamed of reaching for and owning their own destinies, which we know starts with our ability to make our own reproductive decisions, that is somehow wrong in our society. We're also saying men have no responsibility here, that nobody's talking about punishing men who presumably have some part in the equation of an unintended pregnancy. And so we're reinforcing those stereotypical norms by giving these people a pass that ultimately is really hard and disastrous for all of us. Look, one of the things that we know is that women, when women are empowered, when they do have access to all of the reproductive health services that they need, they can actually then go on to live the lives of their choosing. And when they do that and they can engage civically in government and business, then everybody does better, right? Everybody does better. We know that from here in America, and we know that from all over the world, that when we have women participating at high levels of business or at government, that government functions better. There tends to be more focus on the sort of social forces and solving the social forces that keep women and families down. So, you know, what I always say is when we allow these guys to get away with what they're doing and shaming women and holding them back, that we all pay the price.
The truth is, Donald Trump's offensive anti-woman rhetoric has been mirrored by the Republican policy for decades. Think of Donald Trump as not so much qualitatively different from Republicans, just quantitatively different. He's like your average Republican on steroids. Republican proposals will increase poverty, make it harder for working women and men to improve their economic stability, and increase hunger in America. Furthermore, these proposals and policies could also extend and affect the social norms of our nation. I asked Ariana to talk about this.
What's at stake here, right, if these white nationalists continue to inform not only policies, but again, this culture, these social norms, is like a society who's like our communities, like where inequality is even higher and completely acceptable and normalized, where violence against women, against anyone, especially trans women, anybody who's vulnerable is seen as acceptable, where intimidation and abuse of power by our elected officials, by our bosses, by anyone in some kind of authority position over us is seen as acceptable. When I think about, I'm Chicana, Mexican American, and first generation born in the United States. And when I talk to friends and organizers in Mexico about the context and what organizing looks like there, it looks so different. And part of that is because the system of checks and balances is largely not there in Mexico for many, many reasons. That's not to demonize the country or the government. I think there's an entire other kind of conversation on like imperialism we could have there. But when I compare it to ours, like part of the reason our organizing is different, where we can say we can lobby at city council and state and national and see, I mean, now it's going to be different with the right wing dominating, but we can see some kind of change in pressure causing an impact, right? And so what I think could happen is like the demonizing of organizers and criminalizing them in a whole new way, especially organizers that are of marginalized identities. And I also think that along with that, and again, it's not trying to have this analysis of like, we're all in this horrible nightmare and we aren't going to be able to get out of it or do something about it, because I think we can. But I also think that along with that, again, looking at the norms of the patterns of countries like Mexico, where the system of checks and balances has largely been eliminated, like the next step is also like demonizing the media and any kind of opposition, any kind of critical analysis. And we already see that happening with this current administration. So I just think that what's at stake is all of those things happening. And so we need to be able to actually have a conversation about the possibility of how bad it can get and then begin to organize of how we counteract that, but to stop pretending that it's going to be the way we've done it before. Because I think they're like, they're doing all kinds of stuff that are like completely unpredictable and out of the norm. So we need to think about how we organize. It's also not just predictable.
Elise had something to add as well.
I would say that there are two very significant things at stake. One is our economic health and well-being of not just our individual women, but families and our nation as a whole, that we cannot solve for the economic problems in this country if we don't actually solve for the underlying social forces that allow these lawmakers to get away with policies that punish women, be them economic policies, reproductive health care policies, both of which converge in a woman's life to mean that she is always going to be worse off, her family is always going to be worse off, and our society is always going to be worse off. On a different level, I think what's at stake for us is the soul of who we are as a people. America is proudly pluralistic, proudly believes that in self-determination that goes from everything from our individual ability to achieve and succeed in society to determining what our families look like. And that is a deeply American ideal. And if we allow the rise of the right through the president, Donald Trump, to steal that from us, I think it threatens the very fabric of who we are as humans and of our democracy.
We need to fight like never before against the policies of blame, exclusion, and isolation. Divisive politics hurt us all and slow us down on the road to progress. Elise Hoke had something to say about this.
I think it's really important for our brothers on the left to think about this is not our fight to fight alone as women. That you guys need to stand up and call out your brothers when they are saying something that doesn't conform to our collective values. They're going to hear it differently from you. We get really tired of doing it ourselves, and collectively is the way that we progress. And that's true for all of the issues that divide us. It's all of our responsibility together to confront this oppression and this bias.
I firmly believe that women, poor, middle class, rich, Black, Latina, Native, white, must lead us in the fight against the politics of exclusion and isolation in America. To build a movement of women invested in the future of our country with renewed energy. I asked Ariana about this.
I think it's important for all women, for all people to be organizing. I just think that's going to be the biggest way. And by that, it doesn't mean it has to look like on the ground. Organizing can look like all kinds of things. Organizing your work community, connecting with your elected officials, your book club. I have tons of friends now that are like using their book clubs as their base to like call their legislator. Like, I'm just seeing all kinds of stuff happen right now. And I want to continue encouraging it.
This election made clear that America is not a post-sexist society, even though we wish that it was. Nope. In America today, sexism is quite alive and well, unfortunately. Sure, women have seen huge gains in employment and education and economic autonomy since the 60s, but the reality is that two-thirds of all the people working for minimum wage today are women. And whether they're in low-wage jobs or sitting in a corporate boardroom, women are still paid less than their male co-workers. I asked Ariana and Elise what a truly feminist society would look like.
I think it would look like all genders being able to have the ability to live out their lives in a way that is fulfilling, in a way that their basic necessities are taken care of and more, and in a way that allows them to experience joy and that can actually like move our communities in a way where we're not just talking about profit, but we're talking about our well-being, like the well-being of all of us. Sounds so idealistic, but I think like that's, to me, that's what feminism means, right? And that we're like acknowledging all the intersection in our differences when we say woman, because that's varied in class and race and in sexual orientation and what kind of, how you even identify as a woman and so forth. I think it's like using those differences in a way that, not erasing them and saying equality, but like acknowledging them and figuring out what it means to, for each person to have what they need to succeed.
You know, I think the future is in part female, for sure. I think the future is recognizing that the people have a real role to play in leadership, and that elected leaders across the board need to listen and keep their fingers on the pulse of where their constituents are, that we're not waiting to have things handed to us, that we are going to be out there demanding, you know, real change, structural change in the streets. And, you know, you're speaking of bright lights, 14,000 women have filed to run for office since the election at
all right,
the state and federal level, and that's what the future looks like.
You may ask how you as an individual can make a difference. You can. You must, actually. There are people and organizations who've been fighting for you and your family for decades. Find the grassroots group that resonates with you. You know, the one that you just sort of click with. If you can't find one, start one. Join a church, synagogue, mosque that volunteers in the community, at a homeless shelter, free clinic, or diaper bank, and understand that all of these important things, diaper banks, free clinics, free homeless shelters, and the rest, all depend upon political outcomes in elections. Understand that you not only have to be an activist, you have to be a voting citizen who's willing to vote your values. How do we get there? What should the movement look like? What would its vision be?
Call to action, I would say, is get involved. And get involved in two ways, or three ways, actually. I'm going to go with three ways. One, support a woman running for office wherever you are, be it at the local level, the state level. Get involved in her race. Ask how you can actually be helpful. Two, get involved with one of the groups that's really under fire right now. Do what you can. Show up to a rally, make a call to your congressperson, give a couple dollars if you can. And three, all of the groups that you're involved with now ask them to integrate a more substantive gender lens into their work, right? And we do the same with race lens, right? We are the movement that actually believes that our strength is our diversity. And so when we interact with the groups that we've traditionally been involved in, whether it's an environmental group or a social justice group or a legal group like the ACLU, tell them as a member that you want a strong gender lens involved in everything that they do.
There are many ways to continue to be involved in the feminist movement. Many women and allies around women's marches on Washington after Inauguration Day to protest Donald Trump and his anti-woman rhetoric. The organizers of the march and every person who shows up to support it are doing exactly what this country needs, now more than ever. How could people join the work that is already being done to help bring about that movement and the feminist future?
So actually, I would really encourage folks, and this is what I've been telling my family, who most of my family is not like formally politically involved in any kind of way, is to talk to each other and see all the many ways they've already been resisting all the stuff that they've been put, all the injustices that they've been putting up with. And I say that because I think that one of the things that we do as a movement is we act like resistance only looks one way. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't organize and actually structurally think about power and shifting it. That's not what I'm saying. But I actually think if you ask people and encourage them to see the many ways they are already resisting, whether I think about my dad who works at a potato factory and has this, like, his team of folks is, like, Somali, Chinese, and Mexican immigrants. And part of what he does is, like, when Ramadan happens, he has trained his team to collaborate with each other, and they work with the folks who practice, who are Muslims. Right, who practice Islam, to make sure that they don't get in trouble for changing their schedule because of Ramadan, because the bosses aren't actually being inclusive as they should be to figure that out with them. So instead, the team figures it out themselves. That's an incredible work of organizing that, like, nobody's telling my dad that that's what he's doing, but he is. And so I think if we actually start from letting people know that they're already resisting in a whole bunch of ways, and now they're ready to do it even further, just remembering that, because otherwise I think we're going to miss as a movement learning from folks that have been doing it, but maybe not in the ways that we expect or that we've been doing. So that's one thing I would say. And then from there, I think like many people have already said, I would say, like, what are the organizations that are doing work that you can plug into? How do you get involved? Who are your friends that you know, like you, are already involved in an institution, whether it be an organization or a governmental institution that are doing good work? Plug in with them and just start there and keep going. And I would say don't be afraid to expand. There is no expert level. There is no, like, a good grade that you can get on being an activist. Like, part of it is just starting, and then you'll go from there.
Things might not have turned out the way we hoped this last election day, but that doesn't mean we should give up. In fact, it means the exact opposite. We got to redouble our efforts. If the Republicans are successful in wiping away the Affordable Care Act, pushing their draconian budget, and all their other policies, including the wall and the ban and everything else, you know, the implications will be very, very bad for all Americans, especially for women. If we continue to ignore the fact that cis and trans women experience the economy differently, then our society will be poorer for it, particularly as it fluctuates and it changes and it affects middle and low-income women. When 40% of all households with children include mothers who are the primary or only source of income for their families, it's my hope that we can work together to organize with women so that we can preserve the safety net and advance the economic fortunes and social opportunities for everyone, especially women. This is in many ways a moment in which women's success really is American success. And when women succeed, truly all America succeeds. This has been Keith Ellison with We The Podcast. Tune in next time. Special help from Abby Shanfield, Brett Morrow, and Zach Freed. We'll see you next time on We The Podcast.